located at 100 Carson Avenue in Newton. A men's day for complimentary food, music, accessible games, and fun giveaways. Guide dogs and family pets on leashes are welcome. Individuals and teams can register at www.carol.org/walk. That's www.carol.org/walk.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WVBF Littleboro, WRRS Littleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLA Londonderry, WVALLP FL, WDJM Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center, news stories from the Brockton Enterprise.
The Enterprise, Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. Siblings guilty of setting fire to Brockton home they were fostered in. A brother and sister have been convicted on charges that they set fire to a Brockton home they were fostered in as children with the intent of killing those who were sleeping inside. After a 10-day trial in Brockton Superior Court, a jury found Jonathan Geronville, 26, of Worcester, guilty of three counts each of attempted murder, malicious destruction of property, and witness intimidation. His sister, Lucnelli Geronville, 27, of Amherst, was convicted of three counts of attempted murder and one count each of arson and malicious destruction of property. The siblings are scheduled to be sentenced on Thursday, June 22nd. The charges stem from an incident that occurred early in the morning on July 18, 2019. Firefighters responded about 2:30 a.m. to a report of a house fire at 66 Sinclair Road. Mary Lewis, her daughter, and her then 92-year-old mother were all inside the house when the fire broke out, but were able to escape without injury. The ensuing investigation led authorities to the Geronville siblings, who were previously in the foster care of Lewis and lived at that Sinclair Road home. According to court documents, Jonathan and Lucnelli Geronville shared a goal of obtaining guardianship of their younger sister, who was also in the foster care of Lewis. Court documents revealed a lengthy custody dispute over the Geronville's younger sister that led to violent behavior, harassing phone calls, broken windows, and a DCF worker to claim there was something mentally wrong with the siblings. Lewis immediately informed Brockton police they believed Jonathan and Lucnelli were responsible for the fire. Massachusetts State Police Sergeant Thomas M. Bertoletti, who is a fire investigator assigned to the Office of State Fire Marshal, previously wrote in a police report. Investigators learned that a camera had been put up facing the home in July after the first incident of vandalism when a large rock was thrown through the front bay window of the home in June. Surveillance footage showed a small sedan pass in the front of the home slowly, then captures a flickering light that grows in intensity on the right side of the home. Two individuals wearing hoodies are observed running away from the right side of the home as the flickering light continues and grows brighter, Bertoletti wrote. Police say they learned Lucnelli Geronville owned a Honda Civic similar to the vehicle seen in the video. Records obtained by the State Department of Transportation confirmed her car was active on the road between the night of July 17th and the morning of July 18th. Investigators say they determined the car was in the Brockton area at the time of the fire. They also used phone records after obtaining a search warrant. Investigators sought call data and location data for the period of time shortly before and after the fire at 66 Sinclair Road, Bertoletti wrote. The T-Mobile records reflect that both Jonathan and Lucnelli were in Brockton at the time of the arson. The case was prosecuted by Assistant District Attorney Alexander Zane. Ask for help. Stoughton dancer takes own life after giving birth. Ariana Sutton, a dancer and mother of three whose husband is an Easton police officer, took her own life on May 31st after giving birth to twins. Her family is asking for the community's support as they raise awareness about postpartum depression. Catherine Sutton, sister-in-law of Ariana, said the family wants to make sure mothers don't feel shame about attending to their own mental health. "It's so important that you ask for help," she said. "If another family's able to avoid what we're going through right now, it's worth it to share our story." The twins, born a month early, are in the neonatal intensive care unit at Newton Wellesley Hospital, where they are expected to remain through the official due date at the end of the month. It is with heavy hearts that we share the heartbreaking news of Ariana Sutton, a loving mother who tragically took her own life only days after delivering newborn twins, reads the charity appeal on GoFundMe. "The weight of this tragedy is unimaginable, but together we can offer our love, strength, and financial assistance to help this family through their challenging journey." Sutton, 36, died May 31st at her home in Norton, according to her obituary. She co-owned Starline Academy for the Performing Arts in Stoughton with her sister Raina Flaherty. She leaves behind 4-year-old Melody Kai, newborn twins Everly Irene and Rowan Stephen Sutton, and husband Stephen Tyler Sutton, who is an Easton police officer. "He's one of those guys who loves doing his job and helping people," said Tyler Sutton's brother Jason. He said Ariana was a very gentle, kind human being. As of Monday afternoon, well-wishers had pledged $233,685. Donations will help fund child care and shore up the family's long-term finances. Family members who set up the appeal said they hope to raise awareness about postpartum depression and mental health both during and after pregnancy. Massachusetts has a free helpline for mental and behavioral health. Call or text 833-773-2445. By fostering a supportive community, we can strive to prevent other families from experiencing similar tragedies, the appeal read. In memory of Ariana Sutton, let us unite to honor her legacy, celebrate her love for her children, and provide the support her family desperately needs. Family members said Tyler Sutton plans to move back to Easton. Jason and Catherine Sutton, who also live in Easton, are expecting a daughter in August, and the twins will be about the same age as the new arrival. "Ariana wanted these kids so badly. She liked to be a mother," Jason Sutton said. "The two twins are the cutest kids ever." Adriana Sutton was born in Stoughton, raised in Easton, and graduated from Oliver Ames High School in 2005. She went on to earn a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in Dance Education and Dance Performance from the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. While her local students may know her best for her work as a teacher and choreographer at Starline, Sutton was an accomplished dancer with performance credits that included the Martha Graham Dance Company at Philadelphia's Zellbach Theater and the Impact Dance Company in Boston, according to a biography posted on Starline's website as of March. Catherine Sutton said when she thinks of Ariana, she thinks of how happy and full of life she was. "Her personality was so big," she said, "it could happen to anybody. She was just amazing." Postpartum depression may affect about 1 in every 7 women, according to the National Institutes of Health. It is a form of major depression that may take hold at the beginning of pregnancy or within 4 weeks of giving birth. According to the Mayo Clinic, here are symptoms to watch out for. Depressed mood or severe mood swings, crying too much, difficulty bonding with your baby, withdrawing from family and friends, loss of appetite or eating much more than usual, inability to sleep called insomnia or sleeping too much, overwhelming tiredness or loss of energy, less interest and pleasure in activities you used to enjoy, intense irritability and anger, fear that you're not a good mother, hopelessness, feelings of worthlessness, shame, guilt, or inadequacy, reduced ability to think clearly, concentrate, or make decisions, restlessness, severe anxiety and panic attacks, thoughts of harming yourself or your baby, recurring thoughts of death or suicide. Patient opens class action against Compass Medical. What to know? The approximately 70,000 patients who have been affected by the abrupt closure this week of Compass Medical PC have the option of joining the first class action filed against the Quincy-based medical practice. Richard Callanan of Abington is bringing the class action lawsuit on behalf of himself and all others similarly situated current patients of Compass Medical, according to a suit filed in Plymouth County Superior Court on Friday, June 2nd. Compass knew or should have known for months prior to May 31, 2023, that it would be closing its business, but never provided any advance notice to the patients and customers that relied on their facilities for access to medical care, reads part of the complaint. Compass deprived plaintiff and the members of the putative class of the advance opportunity to make adequate arrangements for the continuity of their medical care and future care and treatment planning with non-Compass medical providers and facilities. The lawsuit alleges 7 counts on which the class is seeking payment and injunctive relief due to the company's unlawful business practices. Callinan, on behalf of the class, is suing on a count of negligence, a count of breach of fiduciary duty, a count of tortious interference with contractual and business relations, a count of negligent misrepresentation, a count of intentional misrepresentation, and fraud, among others. Compass Medical, which had 6 medical clinics and urgent care facilities in southeastern Massachusetts, laid off much of its staff and closed all of its offices on the afternoon of Wednesday, May 31st, effective immediately, with no notice to patients or employees. The company provided little information as to what was next for the patients on its website, a concern noted in the lawsuit. Furthermore, Compass failed to provide any reasonable notice, guidance, assistance, or transparencies to its patients and customers as to how to find a new caregiver, how to continue with treatment, how to fill or refill prescriptions, and how to access their medical records to facilitate future care, reads the complaint. The company had not updated the message on its website as of 4:30 p.m. Friday, June 1st. A steady stream of now former patients went to the front entrance of the Dean Street facility in Taunton on Thursday morning and expressed a look of bewilderment when they found the door was locked and no lights were on. Some patients were called on Wednesday evening by staff, but others were not. Catchy's Law Group works on personal injury, workers' compensation, accidental disability retirement, social security disability, and injury dispute cases, as well as cases related to employment law and class action lawsuits in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and Connecticut, according to its website. Attorney Jonathan Sweet is representing the plaintiff. The Attorney General's Office has announced an investigation into the business and its closure. The office has set up a form on its website for patients, employees, and members of the public to file a complaint. In a prepared statement from Compass Medical, Board President Dr. Bruce Weinstein said, "We deeply regret the impact that Compass Medical PC's closure will have on our patients and would like them to know that we are implementing a plan to ensure the continuity of their care. Most Compass physicians will continue to provide medical care in their local communities as part of other practices. Patients needing a medical records request will find a link to fill out on a form on the company's homepage. Patients with emergent need of prescription refills are advised to check with their pharmacies or call Compass at 508-350-2000, according to the statement posted on the Compass website. Restaurant Week is here. Find out what is cooking in Brockton. There's no better way to indulge in the vast cuisine of Brockton than restaurant hopping during the second annual Metro South Restaurant Week. Brockton restaurants are showing out with their menus from vegan Cape Verdean food, giant craft burgers, homestyle Italian, grilled jerk chicken, and plenty more options. From June 4th to June 8th, eateries from all sides and beyond are serving their hot takes on entrees, and some are made especially for this week. The purpose of this is to show local restaurants an extra bit of love and appreciation for all they do for the community. Everyone knows that restaurants have suffered greatly and continue to be challenged. We are eager to encourage everyone to dine out during Restaurant Week and, of course, to continue doing so afterwards, said the Metro South Chamber of Commerce Chamber President Chris Cooney. The organization works with several towns outside of Brockton, including Easton, Avon, Whitman, Abington, East Bridgewater, West Bridgewater, Randolph, and Stoughton. Cabo Vegan is eager to show customers what's new on their menu, from ketchup, Cape Verde's national dish, truffle fries, tamarind juice, and a plant-based meatball sandwich. We bring unique food to Brockton from a mixture of Cape Verdean culture, and it feels good to be able to do that, Tom Andrade, co-owner of Cabo Vegan, said. The vegan restaurant wanted to join the superstar lineup to blow people away on how vegan food can be delicious but healthy. We're super excited to participate in Restaurant Week. We've had so much support from the community and customers from all over traveling to Brockton to try our entrees, Andrade said. The restaurant, located at 20 Main Street, features several vegan seafood dishes, breakfast, soup, dessert, salad, pressed juice, cachupa, baked mac and cheese, rice, and lasagna. Some new items have been added to the menu, including classic American sandwiches, BLT, steak, believe, and cheese, chicken and cutlet sub, meatball sub, grilled cheese, and Moda Bisho burger. There are over 40 restaurants from Brockton participating in Restaurant Week. To see the entire list, please visit metrosouthchamber.com/restaurantweek. You can support Restaurant Week by visiting as many local businesses as you can in the cities and towns participating. Here are some frequently asked questions about Restaurant Week. Which Brockton restaurants are participating? Back Bay Bagel Company, Style Breakfast Brazil Grill and Steakhouse, Brazilian Buffet, Style Restaurant and Bar, Brockton Beer Company, Nutrition, Healthy Shake and Tea Bar, Brockton Roasted Chicken, Peruvian Cabo Vegan, Vegan Catering Cape Cod Cafe, Pizza Fast Betty's Cafe, Leal's Kitchen. South Coast Wind seeks to rebid Massachusetts power contracts. Partnership says costs have risen. After months of uncertainty about the viability of South Coast Wind's power contracts for its $5 billion offshore wind proposal off Massachusetts, the developer now says it is seeking to walk away from the 9 agreements it signed to sell electricity to the state's utilities. The company, a joint venture between fossil fuel giant Shell and Madrid-based renewable energy firm Ocean Winds, announced its intent to terminate the contracts in a filing submitted to the Rhode Island Energy Facility Board. In written testimony to the board, CEO Francis Slingsby said the company has concluded that the sale prices in the contracts are too low to attract financing in light of unforeseen increases in supply chain costs and interest rates. Instead of sticking with the agreements, he said, South Coast plans to rebid the contracts under the latest solicitation for offshore wind power from Massachusetts government. While South Coast has pursued and is open to other solutions, and even after factoring in potential tax incentives, termination and payment of a financial penalty for termination has become the prudent commercial course to realize the project due to material and unforeseen supply chain and financing cost increases affecting the whole offshore wind industry, Slingsby said in a statement. The company, he continued, is committed to the proposal. We continue to move our project through federal and state permitting and have the grid connections necessary to ensure delivery of 2,400 megawatts of power, the full capacity of our lease area, without needing significant and expensive system upgrades, Slingsby said. South Coast, formerly known as Mayflower Wind, applied to the Rhode Island Siting Board last year for permission to run transmission cables through state waters in the Saconette River to the site of the former Brayton Point Power Station in Somerset, where they would plug into the regional power grid. Last November, the board moved to consider suspending the application until questions about financing for the first 1,200 megawatts of the South Coast project were resolved and twice scheduled a show cause hearing. After the company asked for more time to consider its position, the hearing was postponed to June 12th. The filing containing the decision to end the contracts was submitted last Friday. Broader questions about financing were initially raised by Avangrid Renewables, the developer of a second 1,200 megawatt offshore wind project off Massachusetts known as Commonwealth Wind. In a filing last October with the Massachusetts Department of Public Utilities, the company asserted that the project is no longer viable and would not be able to move forward under the terms of the long-term contracts it signed last spring to sell power to utilities. Inflation, shortages of equipment, and interest rates hikes tied to the COVID pandemic and the war in Ukraine had changed the economics of the project, the company said. South Coast, whose agreements were also pending before the DPU, joined with Avangrid in support of a month-long pause in the review of the contracts. In one filing with the agency, South Coast argued that the resource may no longer be economic and financeable without adjustments to the PPAs. In another, the company proposed solutions including raising the power prices in the contracts and exploring the impact of new federal tax incentives. The utilities that signed onto the contracts balked at any changes. The DPU subsequently denied the offshore wind developers' request and ordered them to either commit to the contracts or pull out. While Avangrid eventually did the latter and signaled its intent to bid again, South Coast initially told regulators that it planned to move forward under the current agreements. What appears to have changed the company's mind is a third-party analysis it commissioned of the economics of the contracts. The analysis found that the costs of building and operating offshore wind farms have increased more than 20% since 2019, according to Slingsby's testimony to the siting board. South Coast needs permission from the board to deliver power from its project, which would be built in Atlantic Ocean waters south of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. The company proposes bringing two export cables from the lease area, which is about 59 miles south of the Rhode Island coast. They would run up the Saconette River through the Island Park neighborhood of Portsmouth and across Mount Hope Bay before connecting to the substation where New England's largest coal-burning power plant once stood. In his testimony, Slingsby argued against suspending South Coast's application to the board, pointing to requirements among New England states to increase their supplies of renewable energy. Further staying the proceeding would materially delay and jeopardize the development of the project and would be counter to the very same public policy requirements that drive the need for it, he said. Ukraine dam collapse, a nightmare. A major dam in southern Ukraine collapsed Tuesday, triggering floods, endangering crops in the country's breadbasket, and threatening drinking water supplies as both sides in the war scrambled to evacuate residents and blamed each other for the destruction. Ukraine accused Russian forces of blowing up the Kakhovka Dam and the hydroelectric power station on the Dnieper River in an area that Moscow has controlled for over a year, while Russian officials blamed Ukrainian bombardment in the contested area. It was not possible to verify the claims. The environmental and social consequences quickly became clear as homes, streets, and businesses flooded downstream and emergency crews began evacuations. Officials monitored cooling systems at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, and authorities expressed concern about supplies of drinking water to the south in Crimea, which Russia illegally annexed in 2014. In the downstream city of Kherson, a woman who gave her name only as Tatiana waded through thigh-deep water to reach her flooded house and rescue her dogs. They were standing on any dry surface they could find, but one pregnant dog was missing. It's a nightmare, she kept repeating, declining to give her full name. Both Russian and Ukrainian authorities brought in trains and buses for residents. About 22,000 people live in areas at risk of flooding in Russian-controlled areas, while 16,000 live in the most critical zone in the Ukrainian-held territory, according to official tallies. Neither side reported any deaths or injuries. A satellite photo Tuesday morning by Planet Labs PBC, analyzed by the Associated Press, showed a large portion of the dam's wall, over 1,900 feet, missing. The dam break added a stunning new dimension to Russia's war, now in its 16th month. Ukrainian forces were widely seen to be moving forward with a long-anticipated counteroffensive in patches along more than 621 miles of front line in the east and south. It was not immediately clear whether either side benefits from the dam's collapse, since both Russian-controlled and Ukrainian-held lands are at risk. The damage could also hinder Ukraine's counteroffensive in the south and distract its government, while Russia depends on the dam to supply water to Crimea. Although Kyiv officials claimed Russia blew it up to hinder the counteroffensive, observers note that crossing the broad Dnieper River would be extremely challenging for the Ukrainian military. Other sectors of the front line are more likely avenues of attack, analysts say. Even so, Nigel Gould-Davies, a senior fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, said the alleged Russian destruction of the dam betrays a lack of confidence, a profoundly defensive measure, the lack of confidence in Russia's longer-term prospects in the war. Experts have previously said the dam was in disrepair, which could also have led to the breach. David Helms, a retired American scientist who has monitored the reservoir since the war began, said in an email that it wasn't clear if the damage was deliberate or simple neglect from Russian forces occupying the facility. But Helms also noted a Russian history of attacking dams. Underscoring the global repercussions, wheat prices jumped 3% after the collapse. It's unclear whether the surge in wheat prices was due to a real threat of floodwaters destroying crops. Ukraine and Russia are key global suppliers of wheat, barley, sunflower oil, and other food to Africa, the Middle East, and parts of Asia. Authorities, experts, and residents have expressed concern for months about water flowing through and over the Kakhovka Dam. After heavy rains and snowmelt last month, water levels rose beyond normal, flooding nearby villages. Satellite images showed water washing over damaged sluice gates. Amid official outrage, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky convened an urgent meeting of the National Security Council. He alleged Russian forces set off a blast inside the dam structure at 2:50 a.m. and said about 80 settlements were in danger. Zelensky said in October that Russia had mined the dam and power plant. But Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called it a deliberate act of sabotage by the Ukrainian side aimed at cutting water supplies to Crimea. Both sides warned of a looming environmental disaster. Ukraine's presidential office said some 150 metric tons of oil escaped from the dam machinery and that another 300 metric tons could still leak out. Florida official denies claims by California, says migrants flown to state went willingly. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' administration said Tuesday that three dozen migrants whom the state flew from the U.S. southern border to California on private planes all went willingly, denying allegations by California officials that the individuals were coerced to travel under false pretenses. Two planes arrived in Sacramento on Friday and Monday, each carrying asylum seekers, mostly from Colombia and Venezuela. The individuals had been picked up in El Paso, Texas, taken to New Mexico, and then put on charter flights to California's capital of Sacramento, said California Attorney General Rob Bonta. He's investigating whether any violations of criminal or civil law occurred. Alicia Collins, a spokeswoman for the Florida Division of Emergency Management, said in a statement that through verbal and written consent, these volunteers indicated they wanted to go to California. She also shared a video compilation that appeared to show people signing consent forms and thanking officials for treating them well. The clips had no timestamps, and Collins declined to share additional details about when and where they were recorded. It was the DeSantis administration's first acknowledgement that it coordinated the flights. This isn't the first time DeSantis administration has transported migrants from Texas to other states. Last fall, Florida flew 49 Venezuelans to the upscale Massachusetts island of Martha's Vineyard. The move was intended to protest federal immigration policy. Last month, DeSantis, who recently announced a presidential bid, signed into law a bill approving $12 million for a program to relocate migrants even if they never step foot in Florida. Bonta, who met with some of the migrants who arrived Friday, said they told them they were approached by two women who spoke broken Spanish and promised them jobs in El Paso. The woman traveled with them by land from El Paso to Deming, Mexico, New Mexico, where two men then accompanied them on the flights to Sacramento. The same men were on the flight Monday, Bonta said. He said the asylum seekers have court dates in New York, Utah, and Colorado and carried a document that purports to be a consent and release form that is designed to shield Florida from liability. Of course, what's important is what is actually said and represented and told to the individuals, and we've got good indications of what that was and the fact that it was false, misleading, and deceptive, said Bonta. Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg and faith-based groups are working together to help the newcomers who are staying at two undisclosed locations in the city and have been given food, clothing, and cell phones to contact their families. Sacramento should be a model for the rest of the state and the rest of the nation, Steinberg said at a news conference Tuesday. None of the migrants spoke at the news conference. Gabby Trejo, executive director of Sacramento ACT, a collaboration of religious congregations in the Sacramento area, said all of the migrants had already been given pending court dates by U.S. immigration officials before they were approached in Texas by people promising jobs. Trejo said that they had been lied to and deceived. They couldn't have landed in a better place because Sacramentans know what it means to come together, and we are here to walk with them, Trejo said. Sacramento ACT did not immediately respond to a request for comment later Tuesday about the video released by the DeSantis administration and the assertions that all the migrants went to California willingly. California Governor Gavin Newsom's office, meanwhile, doubled down on its criticism of DeSantis. This is exploitative propaganda being peddled by a politician who has shown there are no depths he won't sink to in his desperate effort to score political points, said Anthony York, a spokesman for Newsom. Newsom indicated in a tweet Monday that California may consider kidnapping charges against DeSantis. Such charges would likely be extremely difficult to prove, particularly given the migrants' signed waivers. Bonta has not directly said he is considering kidnapping charges. As the migrants arrived in California Monday, a Texas sheriff's office announced it had recommended misdemeanor and felony charges for unlawful restraint over the two flights to Martha's Vineyard last year. Johnny Garcia, a spokesman for the Bexar County Sheriff's Office, and said the office is not naming suspects at this time, and it is not clear whether the local district attorney will pursue the charges. DeSantis' latest apparent move to send migrants to California's capital city appears to be a direct shot at Newsom. Though Newsom has no plans to run for president in 2024, he and DeSantis have frequently used each other as political foils as they cast their own governing approach as a model for the nation. Beyond immigration policy, the two have sparred on abortion access, LGBTQ+, and civil rights, and a host of other cultural issues.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, "Play radio station, Talking Information Center."
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLA Londonderry, WVALLPFL, WDJM Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center, news stories from the Taunton Daily Gazette.
This is Pamela Ann Peters with Talking Information Center, reading the Taunton Daily Gazette. T-shirt sparks legal battle. The attorneys representing Lyon Morrison and the town of Middleborough met in court on Wednesday for a preliminary hearing ahead of Morrison's pending trial against Middleborough school officials. On May 31st, the lawyers gathered in a courthouse in Boston to discuss a restraining order against a school requesting that Morrison, a seventh grader at Nichols Middle School, be allowed to wear his "There Are Only Two Genders" T-shirt to school while the lawsuit is underway. The court denied the motion, but a second hearing is scheduled for June 13th to resume conversations about the motion. Morrison's family sued the town and school department officials in April when the school's acting principal, Heather Tucker, sent Morrison home on two occasions after declining to change his T-shirt that read, "There are only two genders." In the second instance, he wore a version of the shirt that said, "Censored," over part of the message. The trial for the lawsuit, if the court decides to hear the case, could begin in August. Morrison's lawyers filed a motion for preliminary injunction that would allow him to wear the shirt in school as the lawsuit is ongoing. Not only was he censored with respect to the gender issue, but also wasn't even allowed to protest the censorship, said Logan Spenya, the senior legal counsel representing Morrison. The first time Morrison wore the shirt, Tucker told him it violated the school's dress code, which states that clothing must not state, imply, or depict hate speech or imagery that targets groups based on race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, religious affiliation, or any other classification. Middleborough Superintendent Carolyn Lyons told Morrison and his father that the message on his shirt targeted a protested class of students, namely in the area of gender identity. "It's not like Liam is bringing up something that's incendiary, that's not already being talked about," Spenya said. "He just wants to be able to participate in the conversation that's already going on." On May 5th, one day after Lyons sent an email to Morrison's father supporting Tucker's decision to send him home, Morrison wore the shirt again, but with the words "two genders" taped over with the word "censored." Now, He's just protesting the fact he's been censored. And then they still make him take the shirt off, Spenya said. Attorneys representing the town and school district did not immediately respond to requests for comment on Wednesday's hearing or the lawsuit. But the school's senior attorney, Kay Hodge, said to Morrison's lawyers in an email, "Those protections prohibit communications, whether oral, written, electronic, or through the wearing of apparel, that may reasonably be considered intimidating, hostile, offensive, or unwelcome based on race, color, religion, national origin, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, or any other status protected by law, and or may otherwise be reasonably likely to lead to disruption of its operations." It is in this legal context that MPs has and will continue to prohibit the wearing of a T-shirt by Morrison or anyone else, which is likely to be considered discriminatory, harassing, and or bullying to others, including those who are gender nonconforming, by suggesting that their sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression does not exist or is invalid. Chris Morrison, Liam Morrison's father, emailed the superintendent on April 1st about the initial instance when his son was sent home in March. The dress code does clearly articulate the expectation that the dress code will be governed by health, safety, and appropriateness. That appropriateness comes at the discretion of the building administration, Lyons said in an email to Chris Morrison. While I cannot share the name, numbers, or names of students and staff that complained about the shirt, I can assure you that there were several students and several staff who did. What to know about Taunton's new public safety complex? City officials and the police and fire departments breathed sighs of relief and excitement back in April when a citywide referendum ballot approved of a debt exclusion for funding a new public safety complex. This was due, in no small part, to the mayor, as well as the police and fire, launching a focused public education campaign about the proposal and the deficiencies of the current aging buildings through building tours and public information sessions. The campaign seems to have worked, as 65% of the total votes were a yes for the new building. Throughout this whole process, it's been about maintaining transparency and trying to get information out to the public. And we want to make sure we continue that, said Mayor Sean O'Connell, whose administration is now focused on the next steps with this milestone project. Under the proposal, the new $79.1 million public safety complex will be located on the 40-acre property at 90 County Street, which the city purchased from the Sisters of St. Dorothy in 2021. Dan Poletta, a project manager for P3 Professionals, overseeing the whole public safety building project, said there are wetlands as part of the property, as well as a floodplain encompassing roughly half the acreage. He said these features are customary with building in New England. P3 Professionals is in the process of developing a protection plan for these sensitive areas, including stormwater management and pollution prevention plans to meet wetlands protection regulations enforced by the state's Department of Environmental Protection. Before any actual building can take place, the long-vacant Villa Fatima preschool and convent building still standing at 90 County Street must be torn down. Estimates to raise that old building are between $750,000 and $1.25 million. But this cost was built into the total debt exclusion number voted on of about $67.7 million, so it doesn't add to the total. Palota said the asbestos was found in the building, so regulations and costs for disposing of hazardous materials have to be followed. Palota said the city will save money in the long run on the public safety project by going for specialty contractors when feasible instead of assigning to a general contractor, in this case, a demolition contractor. We've been tasked with consistently looking for ways to save money. Saving a dime here and there does make a difference, he said. Palota said the raising of the old building will start sometime after Labor Day and the building will be completely cleared off the property before the end of the year. Regarding traffic concerns on County Street, both O'Connell and Poyota said they believe interruptions in the street, like road detours, will be negligible, as the property is large enough to fit all the vehicles, equipment, and space needed for the project. A key feature of the project will be a secondary access point to the new public safety building from Honorable Gordon M. Owen Riverway. Paiota said police and fire need the alternative access for emergency purposes. The secondary access may require building roads over wetlands, which is allowed, Paiota said, if steps are taken to mitigate this crossing, but it still needs approval from the Conservation Commission. Paiota said starting in the fall, the project management team will vet interested general and specialized contractors qualified to work on big capital projects such as public safety infrastructure. We will be getting quality for the residents of Taunton. At the same time, the final construction drawings for the project are scheduled to be completed. Those contractors successfully vetted will be allowed to participate in the actual bidding process, which is scheduled for early winter. We're anticipating a highly competitive bidding process, Taunton's Chief Financial Officer Patrick Del Russo said. Construction will begin sometime in spring 2024, and the public safety complex is expected to be completed by late 2025 or early 2026. The two buildings being emptied, police headquarters and central fire station, will be evaluated to determine how and if reuse is an option. We have time on this. We want to reuse them if we can, O'Connell said. Central Fire Station, built in 1869, is the oldest of Taunton's five fire stations and one of the oldest continuously operating fire stations in the country. O'Connell said the building has great historical value for the city. Police headquarters, meanwhile, located at 23 Summer Street, attached to City Hall, has been considered a temporary space for the department since it relocated there in 2001. The building, previously a supermarket, was originally built in the 1950s. Much has been documented about the persistent issues with space, flooding, mold, ventilation, and HVAC, as well as building code deficiencies plaguing the building. The LaRusso said the administration plans to ask the City Council approval to appropriate money for feasibility studies on these two buildings sometime this fall. Until then, De La Russa said, we don't know what we don't know regarding the reuse of these buildings. The city will also be seeking grants for the same purpose. Human rights campaign LGBTQ plus Americans under attack. The Human Rights Campaign declared a state of emergency for LGBTQ plus people in the U.S. on Tuesday and released a guidebook summarizing laws it deems discriminatory in each state, along with Know Your Rights information and resources to help people relocate to states with stronger LGBTQ plus protections. Sounding alarm about the current political environment, the nation's largest organization devoted to the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Americans said advisories warning against travel to dangerous places aren't enough to help people already living in so-called hostile states. Just a few days into Pride Month, the campaign said it's taking action in response to an unprecedented and dangerous spike in the discriminatory legislation sweeping state houses this state year, with more than 525 anti-LGBTQ plus bills introduced and more than 70 signed into law so far in 2023, more than double last year's number. The emergency declaration is the first in the 40-year history of the HRC, which encompasses a foundation focusing on research, advocacy and education, national and state lobbying campaigns, and a political action committee that supports and opposes candidates for office. It comes as Republican-dominated legislatures around the country have passed bills restricting various aspects of transgender existence, from pronoun usage and bathroom access to medical care and more. Among the latest, one of a series of bills nearing final passage in Louisiana would broadly ban K-12 public school employees in Louisiana from discussing sexual orientation or gender identity in the classroom. The legislation is similar to the Florida law critics say, don't say gay. Healy addresses mistaken use of federal funds for unemployment. Massachusetts is not the only state to mistakenly use federal funds to pay local unemployment benefits, Governor Maura Healey said Monday during a brief appearance outside her office with the state's leadership team. The governor said the state is investigating the $2.5 billion allocation taken from federal coffers to determine if and how much Massachusetts will be asked to reimburse the federal coffers. A number of aid programs have been set up at the time the funds were allocated to Massachusetts with changing requirements. Many states are seeing the same issue, Healy said, adding the state is in discussions with the U.S. Department of Labor. She said that despite ongoing audits of the state's coffers, the discrepancy was just uncovered. Multiple funds had been set up, and money for unemployment insurance was drawn from a federal pot, not a state pot. We will continue to talk with the U.S. Department of Labor to restore the funding and minimize the impact on the state. Senate President Karen Spilka, Democrat Ashland, said the state is still in the fact-finding stage. She indicated that the Senate is still working on a tax relief proposal. Both the governor and the House have proposed relief packages. However, the state has yet to make public any numbers. Spilka said a proposal was coming, yet did not discuss how the most recent discrepancy would affect the package, nor how the significant dip in revenue in April, some $2 billion less than collected in April of the previous year, would affect a Senate proposal. Tax revenue has rebounded, with a significant increase in collections in May compared to the previous year. The State Department of Revenue announced that Massachusetts collected $2.706 billion in May 2023, an increase of $236 million, or 9.5%, over May 2022, and $169 million, or 6.7%, above the most recent benchmark projection for the month. House Speaker Ronald Mariano, Democrat Quincy, said the legislature does not know what effect the use of federal funds to pay local unemployment insurance will have on the state coffers. We don't know how much we owe until we get a bill, said Mariano. Both the House and the governor have unveiled tax relief packages that total less than $1 billion. $654 million was proposed by the House. The governor's package came in to $742 million. The leadership team did not specify how the federal funds were originally allocated, beyond saying they were paid to eligible residents. Now that the state has identified the discrepancy, it will take steps to ensure there is no repetition of the problem. Other topics broached by the leadership team, which includes Lieutenant Governor Kimberly Driscoll, Democrat Salem, was the resettlement process for immigrants to Boston and pushing the federal government to expedite the process to issue work permits for people seeking to settle in the Bay State. We are doing what we can to maximize our resources, Healy said, adding that Massachusetts is not the only state seeking to get incoming migrants to work. In other news, Healy said she is confident the MBTA and its new executive director, Philip Eng, will be able to file a worker safety plan that is acceptable to the Federal Transit Authority. A previous plan that called for changes in operation was rejected by the federal agency, which cited the length of time it would take to incorporate the measures and declared the state would be denied access to rails if the second plan, due Monday, was not approved. Federal authorities suggested these changes must be incorporated within 30 days. Our top priority is a safe and reliable T, said Healy. The governor and her lieutenant will be marching in Saturday's Gay Pride Parade in Boston. We are looking forward to the parade. It will be a special one this year, Healy said. We're proud to be from Massachusetts, a state that prizes equality and protects civil and LGBTQ rights. She encouraged those fearing persecution elsewhere to move to the state. It's great to have all our gatherings back. COVID-19 hit hard, mentally, emotionally, and financially, Healy said. Hyannis Sound to perform at Middleborough Alley's Theater. On Sunday, June 11th, Hyannis Sound will be performing on the patio at the Alley Theater, 133 Center Street. Hyannis Sound is an all-male a cappella group based out of Cape Cod, made of collegiate singers from across the United States. Dating back to 1994, the members of Hyannis Sound have gathered on Cape Cod around Memorial Day to begin rehearsals before embarking on a rigorous performance schedule of over 100 public and private performances across the Cape and Greater New England over the months of June to August. The group's music has received dozens of awards in the world of a cappella music over the years, and the group's members have formed strong bonds among one another as well as the local Cape Cod community. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the group persisted due to the strong support of its fan base and alumni and ended up increasing its social media following to over 700,000 across platforms, garnering acclaim from Alicia Keys, Pentatonix, and the Glamour magazine along the way. This is the 8th time Hyannis Sound will play at the Alley Theater. Proceeds will benefit the Burt Wood School of Performing Arts Scholarship Fund. Email burtwoodschool@aol.com for tickets. Cost is $30 per person. The bartending service in New England is offering a full bar. Millie, fighting in Ukraine has increased, will go on. U.S. Joint Chiefs Chairman General Mark Milley said Tuesday fighting in Ukraine has increased, but he cautioned against reading into each day's operations. There's activity throughout our Russian-occupied Ukraine, and fighting has picked up a bit, Milley said in an interview with the Associated Press at the American Cemetery in Normandy, France, the final resting place of almost 9,400 troops who died during the Allied June 6, 1944, D-Day invasion. Milley said it was up to Ukraine to announce whether its counteroffensive campaign has formally begun, but he said the Ukrainians are ready for this fight. As time goes on, however, he said that the fighting will vary. Separation takes toll on incarcerated moms and kids. Dressed in her Sunday best, pink ruffled sleeves and a rainbow tall tutu, Crystal Martinez's four-year-old daughter proudly presents her with a multicolored bouquet of carefully crafted tissue paper flowers. With her five-year-old son nestled on her lap, laughing in delight, Martinez holds out her arms and pulls the girl into a hug so tight that her glasses are knocked askew. "I want you, I don't want the flowers," Martinez says, smiling and holding her children close. Martinez's five children, including the three aged 13, 10, and 6, last month traveled for 3 hours from Chicago to visit her in Logan Correctional, Illinois' largest state prison for women and transgender people, on the reunification ride. The donation-dependent initiative buses prisoners' family members 180 miles from the city to Logan every month so they can spend time with their mothers and grandmothers. The number of incarcerated women in the United States dropped by tens of thousands because of COVID-19. But as the criminal justice system returns to business as usual and prison populations creep back to pre-pandemic norms, more children are being separated from their mothers, putting them at greater risk of health and behavioral problems and making them vulnerable to abuse and displacement. Black and Hispanic women are more likely to be in prison than white women and are affected disproportionately by family separation due to incarceration. Women held at Logan described the reunification ride, one of the increasingly rare, underfunded program designed to keep families together, as a crucial lifeline. "I thank God that's at least once a month. Some people don't get to see their kids at all," said Jocelyn Allen, whose 5 and 3-year-old children are visiting her with their grandmother. The kids and their caregivers meet at 7 a.m. in a Southside big box store parking lot, blurry-eyed but excited. Organizers hand out snacks, games, water, and coloring supplies as they get on the road. 3 hours later, the charter bus pulls up at the facility's barbed wire gates in Lincoln, Illinois, with children peering from the windows. As families progress slowly through security, shouts of "Mommy!" and squeals of glee fill the prison gym made cheerful with handmade decorations. The prisoners create decorations for the visits, including colorful paper flowers, butterflies, family photos framed in construction paper, and even the bouquet presented to Martinez by her daughter. Families are not allowed to bring anything besides essentials, such as diapers. The number of women incarcerated in the U.S. dropped by about 30% to 146,000 from 2019 to 2020, according to the U.S. Department of Justice data. The nonprofit Prison Policy Initiative attributes that decrease to slowdowns in court proceedings, temporary process changes, and efforts to reduce prison populations due to the pandemic. But the female prison and jail populations are rebounding to pre-pandemic levels. "We're seeing more and more families separated," said Alexis Mansfield, Reunification Ride Coordinator for the Women's Justice Institute. About 58% of the women in state or federal prisons are parents of minor children in the U.S., Black and Latina women experience greater incarceration rates than white women and are about as more likely or more likely to be parents, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. Although women are far less likely to be in prison than men, their incarceration can have an outsized effect on families, Mansfield said. She has witnessed children reuniting with their incarcerated mothers after months or years apart, who immediately disclose they're being abused or they're facing a challenge at school. The bond between mothers and children is so strong, she said, and without seeing their moms, very often kids are in vulnerable positions with nobody to turn to. Gina Fedock, professor at the University of Chicago's Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy and Practice, researches the well-being of marginalized women, particularly those behind bars. Programs like Reunification Ride that offer recurring visits are rare in the U.S., Fedock said. Most states don't have such opportunities, she said. There's a real lack of consistent resources, particularly these types of transportation programs. University of Chicago researchers found only one similar initiative in a nationwide sweep, Our Children in New York, Fedock said. The Reunification Ride, formerly the recipient of public funds that dried up in 2015 during Illinois' two-year budget impasse, has been adopted by nonprofits that rely on crowdsourcing and volunteers to keep the program alive. Each trip costs about $3,000 to $3,500. We realized that this was just too important to stop, Mansfield said. From sports, high school softball, small ball, strong pitching, gets Taunton past Wellesley. Taunton started off its second successive state title defense on the right foot Monday night. Led by another strong outing in the circle from Sam Lincoln and some solid hitting, especially their bunts, the number 2 Tigers, 20-1, took down number 35 Wellesley, 10-9-9, 13-1 in 5 innings in the Division 1 round of 32 to book their place in the Sweet 16. I think it was a great team effort, Taunton coach Michelle Raposo said. We came out with our bats hot in the first inning, and we kept them rolling all the way through. The Tigers strung together 10 hits while drawing 6 walks, scoring twice in the first, 4 times in the second, 5 times in the fourth, and once in the fifth, as Bridget McDougal came home on a wild pitch to Casey DeMora to enact the mercy rule and seal the win for the host. I tell the kids, we want to get base runners on and score every inning, Raposo said. It doesn't always happen for us, so it was really nice to see they were able to get it going. Bella Bork led the way at the plate for Taunton, going 2-for-3 with 2 runs and 2 RBIs, while Mia Torres went 3-for-3 with a run and 2 RBIs. Amy Venturelli went 1-for-2 with 2 runs and 2 RBIs. Kylie Plum went 1-for-3 with a walk and 2 runs. DeMora went 0-for-1 with a run, a walk, and was hit by a pitch. Morgan Fitzgerald went 2-for-2 with a run and an RBI. Brooke Aldrich went 1-for-2 with a run and an RBI. Haley Crockta went 0-for-2 with a run, and McDougal had a walk and a run. The Tigers combined for 4 bunts, 3 of which made the batter made it to first for a single, and 2 of which brought in a run, while 1 eventually became a run, something which Raposo was proud of as has been a focus in practice as of late. We've been working on our bunts a lot, and being able to execute them was really huge for us, Raposo said. We keep preaching that the small game is going to work for us. It allows us to get to the top of the order where our bats are a little bit stronger. So I commend the kids that got it done. That's about it for today for news from the Taunton Daily Gazette. This has been Pamela Peters for the Talking Information Center.
You've just heard news stories from the Taunton Daily Gazette. Please stay tuned for more programming.
Join the Talking Information Center to celebrate 45 years of service here on the South Shore at the 1620 Winery in Plymouth on Thursday, June 8th. The Talking Information Center is a nonprofit organization on the South Shore providing newspapers, magazines, and best-selling books read by volunteers to the print-impaired population of Massachusetts. The evening features great food, a live and silent auction, dancing, and music provided by the band Total Strangers.
Give me that loving. Give me some itty bitty loving.
For more information on the Talking Information Center 45th Anniversary Celebration, log on to ticnetwork.org or text TIC-Bash to 76278. That's the Talking Information Center 45th Anniversary Celebration, Thursday, June 8th at the 1620 Winery at Cordage Park in Plymouth. We hope to see you there.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-3255.